They seemed to think that anything within half an hour of the agreed-upon arrival time was acceptable. Over the years, Oliver had come to accept their lateness and no longer suggested Erica call to check if there had been an accident. Right now, he was pacing the hallway and at intervals making an unendurable squeaking sound by sucking his lower lip beneath his top teeth. Erica went to the bathroom, locked the door behind her, double-checked and triple-checked it was locked, and then pulled out a packet of pills from the back of the bathroom cabinet. It's not that she was hiding them from Oliver. They were right there in the bathroom cupboard for him to see if he wanted, and Oliver would be sympathetic with her need for some sort of anti-anxiety medication. It was just that he was so paranoid about anything that went into his body. Alcohol, pills, food that had passed its use-by date. Erica shared the obsession with use-by dates. According to Clementine, Sam treated use-by dates as suggestions. Her psychologist had prescribed her this medication for those days when she knew her anxiety symptoms, racing heart, trembling hands, overwhelming sense of panic and imminent danger, etc., etc., would be hard to control. Experiment a bit. Start out really low, her psychologist had said. You might find even a quarter of a tablet is enough to get you through. She took one tablet out of the blister pack and attempted to break it in half with her thumbnail. There was a deep groove down the middle of the tablet, as if that was where you were meant to break it. But the design was faulty. It was impossible to break it in two. Her anti-anxiety medication was making her anxious. There was a not especially funny joke there somewhere. Erica had planned to use the medication only when she visited her mother. She did feel nervous about today's discussion with Clementine, of course she did, but it was just normal person anxiety that anyone would experience in a situation like this. However, that was until she'd walked in the door after her conversation with Vid in the driveway to find her husband looking at her with incredulous disbelief, a feather duster hanging absurdly by his side. Clementine couldn't believe they owned a feather duster. "Where's your feather duster?" Erica had said to her once when she visited, and Clementine had fallen about laughing, and Erica had felt that familiar feeling of sick humiliation. Feather dusters were funny. Who knew? How did you know? Weren't they quite useful? "Why would you do that?" Oliver had said. "Why would you say yes to a barbecue with the neighbours today? Of all days. We've had it all planned. We've been planning it for weeks." He didn't yell when he was angry. He didn't even raise his voice. He just spoke in the same tone of polite disbelief he would use to make a call to his internet provider to complain about something unacceptable. His eyes were shiny and slightly bloodshot behind his glasses. She didn't especially like him when he was angry, but maybe everyone disliked their partners when they were angry, and it was therefore normal. "Erica, you've got to get this idea out of your head about there being some objective measure of normality," her psychologist kept telling her. "This normal person of whom you speak doesn't exist. Are you deliberately sabotaging this?" Oliver had said, suddenly intense, as if he were onto something, like a mistake on a bill, as if he'd just worked out that his internet provider was double-charging him. "Of course not," she'd said, outraged at the suggestion. Oliver had tried to convince her to go straight next door and tell Vid that they couldn't make it to the barbecue after all. He'd said he'd do it himself. He'd started walking out the door and she'd grabbed him by his arm to stop him, and for just a few seconds they'd struggled and he'd actually dragged her along the kitchen floor behind him as he tried to walk ahead. It was ungainly and undignified, and it was not them. Clementine and Sam sometimes did this mock wrestling thing in public, which always made Erica and Oliver go rigid with embarrassment. They took pride in not behaving like that. That's why Oliver stopped. He held his hands up high in surrender. "Fine," he said. "Let's just forget all about it. We'll talk to Clementine and Sam another day. We'll just go to the barbecue and have fun." "No way. We're going ahead. It's going to be better this way," Erica told him. "We ask the question. It's out there. We say, you don't need to give us an answer right now. Then we say, okay, off we go to the barbecue. It gives us an end point. Otherwise, we'd just be making awkward conversation." And now they were due any minute. Everything was ready. The craft table for the kids. The plate of crackers and dips. But Erica's heart zoomed like a race car around her chest, and her hands trembled uncontrollably. She swore at the stupid tiny tablet. It wouldn't break. The doorbell rang. The sound was like a swift, violent kick to the stomach. The air rushed from her lungs. The tablet fell from her clumsy fingers. "Doorbell dread," her psychologist called it, almost with satisfaction, because Erica was ticking all the right boxes. "It's very common. Of course you dread the doorbell, because all through your childhood you dreaded discovery." Erica squatted down, the tiles of the bathroom cold and hard against her knees. The floor was clean. The yellow tablet lay in the centre of a tile. She pressed her fingertip to it and looked at it. The doorbell rang again. She put the whole tablet on her tongue and swallowed. Everything depended on the conversation she was about to have. For God's sake, of course she was anxious. She could feel herself breathing shallowly, taking tiny, rapid sips of air. So she put her hand on her stomach and took a deep breath, the way her psychologist had taught her. "Inflate your belly, not your chest." Then she walked out of the bathroom and down the hallway as Clementine, Sam, Holly, and Ruby spilled in through the front door, a tumble of noise and movement and different fragrances, as if there were 10 of them, not just 4. "I bought a bottle of champagne to take when we go next door." Clementine held up a bottle as Erica kissed her hello. "And I brought nothing for you. Is that rude? Oh, wait, I've got that book I promised you, Oliver." She rummaged through her big striped bag for the book. "I did spill some hot chocolate on it. I'm sorry. But you can still read through the chocolatey blotches." "Are you okay, Erica? You look a bit pale."
"I'm fine," said Erica stiffly. "Hello, girls."
The girls were dressed in ballet tutus, leggings and hoodies. They had glittery fairy wings attached to their backs by complicated elastic holster-type arrangements. Both girls needed their hair brushed and their faces washed. "Time to put on fairy wings, but not to have a quick scrub in the bathroom?" Just looking at them gave Erica that same ache she experienced when she watched Clementine perform. "Holly, say hello to Erica."
"Don't mumble," said Clementine. You would think Erica was an elderly aunt who demanded good manners.
"Look her in the eye and say hello. Will you give Erica a cuddle, Ruby?"
"Oh, you too, Holly. That's nice." Erica bent down as the little girls both wound their arms around her neck. They smelled of peanut butter and chocolate. Ruby, her thumb in her mouth, held up her kitchen whisk expectantly. "Hello, whisk," said Erica. "How are you today?" Ruby smiled around her thumb. Although Erica was always polite to Whisk, she didn't really think Clementine and Sam should encourage the personification of an object or Ruby's intense attachment to it. Erica would have nipped it in the bud a long time ago. She thought her psychologist agreed with her, although she was annoyingly equivocal about it. Erica saw that Holly had the little electric blue sequined handbag she'd given her two Christmases ago slung over her shoulder. The ecstasy on Holly's face when she'd opened her present and seen that bag had made Erica's own face contort with such intense feeling she'd had to look away fast. Holly now used her bag to lug around her growing rock collection. Erica was a little worried about Holly's rock collection because it was heading towards obsessive and could obviously lead to all sorts of issues. But her psychologist was quite adamant that Holly's rock collection was nothing to be concerned about, it was perfectly normal, and that it was probably not a good idea to tell Clementine to keep an eye on it. But Erica had still told Clementine to keep an eye on it, and Clementine had promised she would, with that patronizing, kindly look she sometimes got, as if Erica had dementia. Oliver squatted down next to Holly. "I found this the other day," he said, holding up a flat, oval-shaped blue stone. "It's got these little glittery bits." He pointed with his fingertip. "I thought you might like it." Erica held her breath. First of all, why was Oliver encouraging Holly's rock collecting when she'd shared her concerns with him? And secondly, more important, was Holly about to snub him in the hurtful, honest way of children? Clementine had told Erica that Holly liked to find the stones herself. Most of them seemed to be just plain old dirty garden stones, and was apparently completely disinterested when Clementine's lovely father had tried to turn Holly's interest into a learning opportunity and had given her a little gemstone attached to a card with information about its geological properties. Holly took the stone and examined it through narrowed eyes. "This is a good stone," she pronounced, opening her bag to add it to her collection. Erica exhaled. Oliver straightened, pulling on his trouser legs, exultant. "What do you say?" said Clementine, at the same time as Holly said, "Thank you, Oliver," and then looked up at her mother balefully. "I was saying thank you." Clementine really should have given Holly a chance to speak before she jumped in. Erica clapped her hands. "I've got a craft table set up for you two," she said. "That sounds exciting, doesn't it, girls?" said Clementine in a fake, jolly tone, as if Erica had actually suggested something inappropriate and boring for children, like crochet. "Watched the game last night?" said Sam to Oliver. "Sure did," said Oliver, with the air of a man about to finally take a test for which he'd been studying hard. He had, in fact, watched the game last night specifically so he could answer this question from Sam, as if faking an interest in sports would affect today's outcome. Sam looked delighted. Normally, sports was a conversational dead end with Oliver. "What about that tackle in the first half, eh?" "Come on now, we don't want to talk about football," interrupted Clementine. "Put us out of our misery. What's this mysterious thing we need to talk about?" Erica saw Oliver look panicked. They were still milling about in the hallway. This was not the way it was meant to happen. We're not saying a word until everyone is sitting quietly in their designated positions, said Erica. Maybe the pill was working. Her heart rate felt steady.
Oh, she's a herrschluchtige Frau, said Clementine.
What's that? Said Holly.
It means bossy woman in German, said Erica. I'm surprised your mum remembers such a long word. Shall we ask her to spell it?
When they were 13, Erica and Clementine had studied German at school and developed a love of German insults. They enjoyed the brutal snap of those Germanic syllables. Sometimes they'd shove each other at the same time, just enough to make the other one nearly but not quite lose her balance. It was one of their few shared passions.
Just because she got a higher mark than me, Clementine rolled her eyes.
Oh, only 20 marks or so higher, said Erica.
Dummkopf.
She got exactly 22 marks more than Clementine. Clementine laughed, fondly, it seemed, and Erica felt herself relax. She had to remember to always be like this, sort of flippant and cool, not so intense. Or she could be intense, but in an amusing, endearing way, not annoyingly so. In a few minutes, they had everyone sorted. The girls were happily using their pink glitter glue sticks on cardboard. Erica saw with vindicated pride that the craft table was a hit. Of course it was. Little girls loved crafts. Clementine's own mother used to have a craft table like this for her when she was little. Erica had adored that craft table. The tidy little jars of gold star stickers, the pots of glue. Surely Clementine had loved that table as much as Erica. So why hadn't she set one up for her own children? Erica had known better than to ever suggest it. Too often she saw her interest in the girls misinterpreted as criticism. I love these sesame seed crackers, said Clementine, as they sat opposite each other in the living room. She shuffled forward in a sitting position to take a cracker, and Erica saw a glimpse of cleavage. White bra. The emerald pendant necklace that Erica had gotten her for her 30th birthday dangled from her neck. The coffee table was too far away from the couch, so Clementine just sank gracefully to her knees, like a geisha girl. She wore a turquoise cardigan over a white t-shirt, a full skirt in a fabric featuring giant white daisies against a yellow background, the skirt spread around her on the floor. She was a splash of colour in the middle of Erica's beige living room. I remembered you either loved them or hated them, said Erica. Clementine laughed again. I'm just so passionate about my crackers.
She's crackers about crackers, said Sam,
as Clementine, without asking, cut him a piece of cheese, put it on a cracker, and handed it to him.
Dad joke, said Clementine, rolling her eyes as she sank back on the couch.
Had a manicure, have you, mate? Said Oliver to Sam.
And Erica thought, what's he talking about? Is he trying to be all matey and I'm a straightforward Aussie bloke just like you, but he's getting it all wrong? But Sam held up his hand to show that his fingernails were painted coral pink.
Yep, Holly's work, he said. I had to pay for the privilege.
She doesn't do a bad job, said Clementine. We just have to remember to take it off before he goes to work tomorrow, so no one questions his manhood.
No one would question my manhood, Sam thumped his chest, and Oliver laughed.
Maybe a bit too enthusiastically, but really, it was all good.
The tone felt just right.
Well, said Oliver. He cleared his throat. Erica could see his knee jiggling. He put a hand on it, as if to still it.
So, to give you some background, began Erica.
This must be serious stuff, Clementine raised an eyebrow.
Background.
We've been trying unsuccessfully to get pregnant for the last 2 years, said Erica. Just get it out there. Move it along. Clementine removed the cracker she'd been about to bite from her mouth and held it in front of her.
You've what?
We've been through 11 rounds of IVF, said Oliver.
What? Said Clementine.
I'm sorry to hear that, said Sam quietly.
But you never...
Clementine looked flabbergasted.
I thought you didn't want children. You always said you didn't want children.
We want children very much, said Oliver. He lifted his chin.
That was when I was younger, explained Erica. I changed my mind.
But I assumed Oliver felt the same way, said Clementine. She looked at Oliver accusingly, as though she expected him to back down, admit she was right and say, Oh, sorry, of course you're right. We don't want children at all. What were we thinking?
I always wanted children, said Oliver. Always.
His voice thickened. He cleared his throat.
But 11 rounds of IVF? Said Clementine to Erica. And you never told me? You went through all that without saying a word? You kept it a secret for the last 2 years? Why wouldn't you tell me?
We just decided to keep it to ourselves, said Erica uncertainly. Clementine sounded hurt, almost angry. Erica felt everything shift. Wait, was that wrong? It had never occurred to her that she had the power to hurt Clementine. But now Erica saw that, yet again, she'd got it wrong. Clementine was her closest friend, and you were meant to share things with your friends, your problems, your secrets. Of course you were. My God, everyone knew that. Women were notorious for sharing everything. The problem was that Oliver had been so insistent that they tell no one about any of it. And to be fair, Erica hadn't objected. She had no desire to share. She didn't want to tell anyone about it. Her fantasy had been calling Clementine with the good news that never came. And after all, she had plenty of experience keeping secrets.
I'm sorry, she said. No, said Clementine. She still hadn't eaten her cracker. Her face was pink. I'm sorry. Gosh, this isn't about me. Of course, it's fine if you didn't want to talk about it. I respect your privacy. I just wish I could have been there for you. There were probably times when I was complaining about the girls and you were just thinking, Oh, for God's sake, shut up, Clementine. Don't you know how lucky you are? She sounded like she was close to tears. There had been times like that.
Of course I never thought that, said Erica.
Anyway, we know now, said Sam. He put his hand over Clementine's. So, obviously, anything you need.
He looked wary. Maybe he thought they needed money. There was silence for a moment.
So,
The reason we wanted to talk to you today, began Oliver.
He looked at Erica. This was her cue. But it was all wrong.
She'd stuffed it up.
If she'd just been like a normal friend about this the whole way through, if she'd told Clementine right back at the beginning when they'd first started IVF, then this conversation would have had a proper, solid foundation. Each disappointment, each failure over the last 2 years would have been like a deposit of sympathy. They could have called on that deposit. But now Erica sat opposite a confused, hurt friend, and there was nothing in the bank to withdraw. Self-loathing rose within Erica's stomach like nausea. She never got it quite right. No matter how hard she tried, she always got it just a tiny bit wrong. My doctor has said that the only option now for us is to find an egg donor, she said, because my eggs are of very poor quality. Useless, in fact. She tried to bring some lightness into the conversation, the way it was in the hallway, but she could tell by everyone's faces that it wasn't working. Clementine nodded. Erica could see she had no idea what was coming next. A memory came to her of blonde, pretty Diana Dixon marching up to Clementine in the school playground and grimacing at the sight of Erica, the sort of grimace you might give a cockroach. "Why are you playing with her?" said Diana. And Erica never forgot either Clementine's lightning-quick flash of humiliation or the way she lifted her chin and told Diana, "She's my friend." "So we wondered," prompted Oliver. He waited for Erica. It was clearly her job to ask the question. Clementine was her friend. But Erica couldn't speak. Her mouth felt dry and hollowed out. The tablet, maybe. It was probably a side effect. She'd meant to read the little leaflet about side effects. She fixed her eyes on the yellow daisies on Clementine's skirt and began to count them. Oliver spoke up, like an actor saving the day by taking someone else's line in the script. There was a thin edge of hysteria to his voice. "Clementine," he said, "we're asking. The reason we wanted to talk to you today, we're wondering if you would consider being our egg donor." Erica looked up from the daisies at Clementine's face and saw an expression of utter revulsion fly across it as fast as the flash of a camera. It was there, and gone so quickly, she could almost choose to believe she'd imagined it. But she hadn't imagined it, because reading faces was one of her skills. It was a legacy of a childhood spent reading her mother's face, monitoring, analysing, trying to modify her behaviour in time, except that her skill rarely allowed her to get things right. It just meant that she always knew when she got things wrong. It didn't matter what Clementine said or did next. Erica knew how she really felt. Clementine's face was composed and very still. It was the look of focused concentration she got when she was about to perform, as if she were taking herself to another plane, a transcendent level of consciousness that Erica could never reach. She pushed back a stray lock of hair behind her ear. It was the same long, curly lock of hair that fell towards her cello when she played, somehow never quite touching the strings. "Oh," she said steadily. "I see." Chapter 17. The Day of the Barbecue.
So this is a big thing we're asking of you, and it's absolutely not something we'd expect an answer on right away, said Oliver.
He leaned forward with his elbows resting on his knees, his hands locked together. He brought to mind a mortgage broker who had just given a lengthy explanation of a complex loan arrangement. He looked gravely at Clementine and indicated a cream manila folder on the coffee table in front of him.
We have some literature ready for you.
He enunciated the four syllables of the word literature with tiny lip smacks of satisfaction. It was the sort of word that both Oliver and Erica found soothing, like documentation, like procedure. It explains exactly what would be involved. Frequently asked questions. The clinic gave it to us to pass on, but if you'd rather not take it now, that's fine. We don't want to overload you, because at this stage we're just, you know, putting it out there, I guess is the right way to describe it.
He sat back against the couch and glanced at Erica, who, bizarrely, had chosen this moment to kneel down beside the coffee table and cut a piece of cheese from the tiny, Clementine didn't know they made them that small, wheel of brie. Oliver looked away from his wife and back at Clementine.
All we're saying today is this something you would possibly consider? But as I said, we don't need any response at all from you. And by the way, if down the track you were to say you would consider it, there's a mandatory cooling off period of 3 months, and you can pull out any time. Any time, no matter how far we progress. Well, not quite any time. Not once Erica is pregnant, obviously.
He chuckled nervously, adjusted his glasses, and frowned.
Actually, you can pull out right up until when the eggs are inseminated, but at that point they legally become our property.
His voice drifted.
Sorry, that's far too much information at this early stage. I'm nervous. We're both a bit nervous.
Clementine's heart twisted for him. Oliver generally avoided hazardous topics of conversation. Anything political, sexual, or overly emotional. But here he was soldiering on his own through this most awkward of conversations because he wanted so badly to be a father. Was there anything more attractive than a man who longed for children?
Sam cleared his throat. He put his hand on Clementine's knee.
So, mate, I'm just getting my head around this. It would be your...
It would be my sperm, said Oliver. He coloured.
I know it all sounds sort of... No, no, said Sam. Of course not. I've got a good friend who went through IVF, so I've got a basic sort of understanding of the, you know, ins and outs.
The ins and outs.
She'd tease him about that unfortunate turn of phrase later on. Clementine knew Sam was talking about his friend Paul, and that in reality, Sam had been entirely oblivious to the process, except for his joy at the outcome, a baby boy for Paul and Emma. Sam loved babies. In Clementine's experience, no man loved babies more. Sam was the first in line for a cuddle of a newborn and would scoop older babies straight from their parents' arms. But he hadn't wanted to hear Paul and Emma talking about egg retrievals and embryo transfers. Erica lifted a cracker between her fingers.
More cheese, Sam?
Everyone stared at her.
No thanks, Erica, said Sam. I'm good.
It was clearly Clementine's turn to say something, but there was a constricted feeling around her chest that seemed to be preventing her from talking. She wished one of her daughters would yell for her, but predictably they were being quiet and well-behaved the one time she would have liked them to interrupt. They seemed to love Erica's craft table. Erica would be an excellent mother. A craft table, watch your manners, hand sanitizer in the handbag sort of mother. Oliver would be a good father too. Clementine could see him doing something old-fashioned and painstaking with a dear, studious little boy.
Like making model aeroplanes.
To their own child, thought Clementine despairingly. They'd be good parents to their own child, not my child. It wouldn't be your child, Clementine. But it would. Technically, as Holly would say, it would be her child, her DNA. People do this for strangers, she told herself. They donate eggs just to be nice, to be kind, to people they've never met. This was her friend, her best friend. So why was the word no so loud in her head? Well, she said finally, inadequately. This is a lot to think about. Absolutely, said Oliver. He looked again at Erica, but she was still no help to the poor man. She had laid out a line of crackers and was placing a thin sliver of cheese on each one. Who did she think was going to eat them? Oliver blinked once and smiled apologetically at Clementine. Please don't think this is the end of the road for us if you decide it's not for you. There will be other options. It's just that you were the first person we thought of, being Erica's closest friend, and you're the right age, and you're done having kids. Done having kids? Said Sam. His hand tightened on Clementine's. We're not necessarily done having kids. Oh, said Oliver. Sorry, gosh, I thought that is, Erica was definitely under the impression. You said you'd rather poke your eyes out than have another baby, said Erica to Clementine in that truculent way she had when she could disprove something with facts. I asked you. It was last September. We had Yum-Cha. I said, are you done with babies? You said, I'd rather poke. I was joking, interrupted Clementine. Of course I was joking. She hadn't been joking. Oh, God. But was this her only way out now? Would she have to give birth to get herself out of this situation? Well, you can certainly still donate eggs if you want to have more children, said Oliver. Three deep, corrugated lines furrowed his forehead, like a cartoon character frowning. The clinic does prefer known donors to have completed their families, but it's all there in the literature. You said that you'd rather poke your eyes out than have another baby, said Sam to Clementine. You really said that? I was joking, repeated Clementine. I'd probably had a bad day with the kids. Of course, she'd always known this was an issue. Her deluded hope had been that he'd just, well, get over it. Every time the girls were badly behaved or when the house seemed too small for the four of them and they kept losing things, or when they worried over their financial situation, She secretly hoped that Sam's hopes of another baby were gently, sensibly fading away. She should never have told Erica she was done with babies. It was a flippant remark. A carefully constructed flippancy was her default position with Erica. She should have confided that Sam didn't feel the same way, because there had always been the risk it could come up in conversation, just as it had today. She rarely shared information like that with Erica. She deliberately withheld herself. With other friends, she didn't think twice. She chatted about whatever came into her head because she knew they'd probably forget half of what she said. There was no one else in the world, not her mother or her husband, who listened so ravenously to what she had to say, as if every word mattered and was worthy of being filed away for future reference. As a child, whenever Erica had come to play, she would first do a peculiar audit of Clementine's room. She'd open every drawer and silently examine its contents. She'd even get down on her hands and knees to look under Clementine's bed while Clementine stood, mutely infuriated, but at her mother's request, being kind and polite. Everyone is different, Clementine. Erica had obviously learned some social niceties as a grown-up and didn't go through her cupboards anymore, but Clementine still sensed that avaricious gleam in Erica's eyes whenever they were in conversation. It was as though Erica's desire to look under Clementine's bed was still there, and so was Clementine's mute, outraged resistance. But the really ironic thing was that it now appeared Erica had the same policy of not sharing anything important. She'd kept this huge secret for the past 2 years, and Clementine's first reaction had been to feel hurt by the revelation. Oh yes, it was all fine for Clementine to lord it over Erica from up high on her friendship pedestal, graciously bestowing gifts. Why, yes, Erica, you may be the godmother of my firstborn. So, okay, fine then. If their friendship was an illusion and had no substance to it on either side. But now Erica was asking something you asked only of a dearest friend. She looked down at the cracker in her hand and didn't know what to do with it. The room was silent, except for the gentle babble of Holly and Ruby in the next room, doing their craft like little angels, as if in rebuke to Clementine. Look how darling we are. Give Daddy another baby. Help your friend have a baby. Be kind, Clementine, be kind. Why are you so unkind? A crazy, complicated symphony of feelings rose in her chest. She wanted to throw a tantrum like Ruby, to fling herself to the floor and bang out her frustration with her forehead on the carpet. Ruby always made sure it was carpet before she started banging her head. Sam moved his hand from her leg and shifted slightly away from her. He'd left a triangle-sized piece of cracker on Erica's spotless white leather couch. Oliver removed his glasses, and his eyes looked bruised and tender, like those of a tiny animal emerging from hibernation. He polished them with the edge of his t-shirt. Erica sat immobile and upright, as if at a funeral, her eyes following something past Clementine's head. That's Dakota, she said. Dakota? Asked Clementine. Dakota, said Erica, the little girl from next door. Vid must be getting impatient. He sent her over to collect us for the barbecue. The doorbell rang. Erica jumped violently. Sam leapt to his feet like a man whose name has finally been called after a tedious wait in a bureaucratic institution. Let's go have a barbecue.
Chapter 18. When Sam and Clementine got back from the restaurant and walked in the door, shaking their umbrellas, home from their date night less than 2 hours after they'd left, Clementine's mother was aghast.
What happened?
She turned off the television and pressed a hand to her throat as if preparing herself for terrible news.
Why are you back already?
We're so sorry, Pam, said Sam. The service at the restaurant was slow and in the end we decided we weren't really in the mood for going out to dinner.
But the reviews were outstanding, said Pam.
The restaurant had been her recommendation. She looked at them expectantly, as if she hoped she could convince them to turn around and go back into the city and give it another go. Clementine saw that her mother had folded a basket of clean laundry into neat little piles on the couch and had just now rewarded herself with a cup of tea and a single ginger nut biscuit on a saucer, probably to enjoy while she watched Midsummer Murders. Clementine felt a stab of regret. It seemed this was her default state now, regretful. It was just the degrees of regret that changed.
I'm sorry, Mum, she said. I know you
thought a romantic dinner could save our marriage. She glanced at Sam, and he returned her look as passively as a stranger on a bus.
We both felt sort of tired, I guess.
Pam's shoulders sagged.
Oh, dear, she said. I'm sorry if I pushed you into it. Maybe it was too soon. I just thought it would be good for you to get out.
She visibly rallied.
Well, how about I make you both a cup of tea? I just made myself one. The water is still hot.
Not for me, said Sam. I might just... He looked around the room for inspiration. I might just go for a drive.
Go for a drive where? Asked Clementine.
She wasn't going to help him. She wasn't going to pretend that going for a drive in the pouring rain to escape a cup of tea with your mother-in-law and wife was reasonable. But of course, her mother was eager to let Sam slip straight off any hook.
Of course you can go for a drive, she said. Sometimes you need to just drive. It's meditative. Right now, you two need to be kind to yourselves.
Sam gave Pam a grateful smile, ignored Clementine, and left the house, noiselessly closing the front door behind him.
You've got the place looking very clean and tidy, said Pam, when they were both sitting down with cups of tea and ginger nut biscuits.
She gave her a quizzical, almost uneasy look.
All I could find to do was fold this tiny bit of laundry. It's like you've got a housekeeper or something.
We're just trying to be more organized, said Clementine. She and Sam had both become manic about housework since the barbecue, as if they were being monitored by some unseen presence.
Although we still can't find things.
Well, good, I guess, but there's no need to kill yourselves. You both look exhausted, to be honest.
She glanced at Clementine over her teacup.
So I take it tonight wasn't a success then?
I'm sorry we had you babysitting for no reason, said Clementine.
Pam flicked a hand. It's my pleasure. You know that. It's good for your father and me to have a night off from each other too. Space is good for a marriage. You have to have your own interests.
She frowned. As long as you don't become obsessive about them, of course. Pam's father, Clementine's grandfather, had been a schoolteacher who spent every spare moment he had working on the great Australian novel. He worked on it for over 15 years before he died in his 50s of complications caused by pneumonia. Clementine's grandmother was apparently so angry and grief-stricken and bitter about all the time he'd wasted on that stupid bloody book, she'd tossed the entire manuscript in the bin without reading a single word. How could she not read it? What if it was the great Australian novel? Clementine always said. But Pam said Clementine was missing the point. The point was that the book had ruined their marriage. Pam's father loved the book more than he loved her mother. As a consequence, Pam took a keen, possibly fanatical, interest in monitoring the quality of her own marriage. She read books with titles like Seven-Second Secrets for Supercharging Your Marriage. Clementine's easygoing, laconic father tolerantly endured weekend marriage retreats. He went along or gave the appearance of going along with everything Pam suggested, and it appeared to have worked because they were undeniably fond of each other. Pam was just as vigilant about the quality of other people's marriages as she was her own, although she was self-aware enough to know that people didn't always appreciate her vigilance. "I don't suppose you'd think about seeing a marriage counsellor, would you?" she said now to Clementine, "just to talk things through." Well, no, I don't think so," said Clementine. "There's nothing really to say, is there?" "I suspect there's a lot to say," said Pam. She bit into her biscuit with her strong white teeth. "Well, how was your day? Any, gigs?" Even after all these years, she still said the word gig self-consciously, in the same way that she always said croissant with the proper French pronunciation, but with an apologetic, self-deprecating look to make up for her pretentiousness. "I did one of my talks," said Clementine. If Sam's face showed a spasm of irritation when she mentioned the talks, her mother's face showed a spasm of delight. "Of course! I forgot you had one scheduled for today. How did it go?" "I'm so proud of your bravery, Clementine. I really am. How was it?" "Erica came along to watch," said Clementine, somewhat bizarrely. "Not bizarrely at all. She was probably just being supportive." "I never noticed before that Erica has exactly the same haircut as you," said Clementine. "I guess it helps that we go to the same hairdresser," said Pam. "Maybe dear old Dee can only do one type of haircut." "I didn't know you two went to the same hairdresser," said Clementine. "How did that come about?" "I have no idea," said Pam hurriedly. She was always keen to rush over the details of exactly how much time she spent with Erica, as if it would make Clementine feel envious or usurped. She was too old for that now, although she could still feel the lingering memory of her childhood insecurities. "She's my mother, thank you very much." "Speaking of Erica," said Pam, "I actually called her tonight while you were out just to give her an update on the Sylvia situation, which, well, let's just say things aren't improving as she gets older. But anyway, Erica told me something a little upsetting," Pam reflected, "although she didn't seem that upset about it." She used the side of her hand to absentmindedly sweep together some crumbs on the coffee table into a microscopic pile. "Apparently, Oliver found a body, the poor boy." "What do you mean, he found a body?" For some reason, Clementine felt herself experiencing a flash of anger directed at her poor mother. It just seemed so outlandish. "He just stumbled upon a body, did he? He was just out for a run and he tripped over a corpse?" Pam looked at her steadily. "Yes, Clementine. Oliver found a body. It was one of their neighbours." Clementine froze. It was Vid she thought of first. Big men like Vid were prone to dropping dead of a heart attack. She didn't want to see Vid again, but she didn't want him to die.
"The old fellow two doors down from them," said Pam.
Clementine felt everything unclench.
"Harry," she said. "That's it. Did you know him?" asked Pam.
"Not really," said Clementine, "from a distance. He didn't like it if you parked on the street anywhere near his house. Once there was a delivery truck in Erica's driveway when we were visiting, and so we had to park on the street near his driveway. He suddenly emerged from behind his azalea bush, yelling abuse. Sam told him that his property line didn't extend to the street. He was polite, of course, but you know what the horrible man did? He spat at us.
Holly and Ruby were thrilled. We lived on that story for days, the spitting man."
"He was probably lonely," said Pam.
"Unhappy. Poor old fellow."
She tilted her head, listening to the rain.
"It's really got a settled feeling, that rain, hasn't it? As if it's here to stay."
"It makes everything seem diabolically difficult," said Clementine.
"You know, I'm so happy that Erica is still seeing that lovely psychologist," said Pam, her eyes brightening at this sudden pleasurable thought. She loved anything to do with mental health. "It means she'll be armed with all the tools she needs to deal with her mother."
"She might not be talking to the psychologist about the hoarding at all," said Clementine. "She might be talking about her infertility."
"Infertility?"
Pam put down her teacup abruptly. "What are you talking about?" So Erica hadn't confided in Pam either, even after all this time. What did that signify?
"But she and Oliver don't want children. Erica was always so vocal about not wanting children."
"She wants me to donate my eggs to her," said Clementine blandly. She had been putting off telling her mother about Erica's request, not wanting Pam's forthright opinions further complicating her own already complicated feelings. But now she was conscious of a childish desire for her mother to fully comprehend the continuing cost of being Erica's friend.
"Look what you asked of me, Mum. Even now, all these years later, see how kind I am, Mum? I am still being so kind."
Although who was she kidding? Donating your eggs was the sort of purely philanthropic act her mother would have killed for the chance to perform. Clementine used to tell her father that if she were ever in a car accident, he needed to double-check that she really was dead before her mother began enthusiastically handing out Clementine's organs.
"Donate your eggs," said Pam.
She gave her head a little shake as if to make things settle back into place.
"But how do you feel about this? When did she ask you?"
"The day of the barbecue," said Clementine, "before we went next door." She thought of Erica and Oliver sitting so straight-backed and tense on their white leather couch. Only a childless couple would own a white leather couch. They both had such neat little heads. Oliver's spectacles were so clean. They had seemed so endearing in their earnestness. And then that instant feeling of distaste at the gynecological word eggs and the irrational sensation of violation, as if Erica were proposing she reach right over and help herself to part of Clementine, to some deeply intimate part of her that she'd never get back, followed instantly by that old familiar shame, because a real friend wouldn't think twice. She had thought she wouldn't need to feel that awful shame ever again because Erica was fine now, in a good place, as people said, and no longer asking for more than Clementine could give.
"Oh my gosh," said Pam. "What did you say?"
I didn't say anything at the time, said Clementine, and we haven't talked about it since then. I think Erica is hoping I'll bring it up soon, and obviously I will. I'm just picking the right moment. Or I'm procrastinating. Maybe I am procrastinating. She could feel something ascending within her, a rising scale of fury, a melody from her childhood. She looked at her mother's familiar face, the grey fringe cut in that unflinching straight line over her protuberant brown eyes, the big determined nose, the large utilitarian ears, for hearing, not earrings. Her mother was all strength and certainty, never a moment's doubt over a spider or a tight parking spot or a moral dilemma. "That little girl needs a friend," she'd told Clementine the first time she saw Erica in the school playground. The different kid. The unpleasant-looking kid, sitting cross-legged on the asphalt, playing with old brown leaves and ants. The kid with the greasy blonde hair flat against her head, the pasty dead white skin and the scabby sores dotting her arms. Flea bites, Clementine learned many years later. Clementine had looked at the little girl and looked back at her mother and felt one enormous word caught in her throat. No! But you didn't say no to Pam, especially not when she used that tone of voice. So Clementine went and sat down opposite Erica in the playground and said, "What are you doing?" And she'd glanced over at her mother for the nod of approval, because Clementine was being kind, and kindness was the most important thing of all, except that Clementine didn't feel kind. She was faking it. She didn't want anything to do with this dirty-looking little girl. Her selfishness was a nasty secret she had to hide at all costs, because Clementine was privileged. Pam was a woman ahead of her time in her use of the word privilege. Clementine learned to feel bad about her white middle-class privilege long before it became fashionable. Her mother was a social worker, and unlike many of her exhausted, jaded, bitter jokes co-workers, Pam never lost her passion for her vocation. She worked part-time while bringing up three children, and she loved to share unflinching accounts of what really went on in the world. Clementine's family wasn't particularly wealthy, but privilege was measured on a different scale when you saw what Pam did. Life was a lottery, and Clementine knew from a very early age that she had apparently won it. "What are you going to say to Erica?" said Pam. "What choice do I have?" said Clementine. "Of course you have a choice, Clementine. It will be your biological child. It's a big thing to ask. You don't..." "Mum," said Clementine, "think about it." For once, she was the unequivocal one. Her mother hadn't been there at the barbecue. Her mother didn't have those ghastly images burned forever across her memory. She watched her mother think about it and come to the same conclusion. "I see what you mean," she said uneasily. "I'm going to do it," said Clementine fast, before her mother could speak. "I'm going to say yes. I have to say yes." Chapter 19.
"Are you okay? You're not still upset about our friend, Harry?"
said Vid, lying next to Tiffany in their dark bedroom while the rain continued its incessant soundtrack. Thanks to their red velvet absolute blackout curtains, Tiffany could see absolutely nothing but black. Normally the darkness felt luxurious, like a hotel room, but tonight it felt suffocating, like death. There was too much death on her mind these days. Although she couldn't see Vid in their king-sized bed, she knew he would be lying flat on his back, his hands crossed behind his head like a sunbaker. He slept the entire night like that, without changing position. It still made Tiffany laugh after all these years. It was such a casual, confident, aristocratic approach to sleep.
"You may approach sleep."
So very Vid. "He wasn't our friend, was he?" said Tiffany. "That's the point. He was our neighbor, but he wasn't our friend."
"He didn't want to be our friend, you know,"
Vid reminded her. It was true that if Harry had been at all interested in friendship with them, he would have got it. Vid was open to friendship with anyone he encountered in his daily life, baristas and barristers, service station attendants, and cellists. Definitely cellists. If Harry had been a different sort of old man, they would have had him over all the time, and they would have noticed his absence so much sooner. Soon enough to have saved his life? Today, the police had told Oliver and Tiffany that it seemed most likely that Harry had either fallen down the stairs or had a stroke or heart attack and perhaps had fallen as a result. There would be a coroner's inquest. It seemed like a formality. The police were going through a process, ticking off the boxes. "He probably died instantly," the policeman told Tiffany. But how would he know? He had no medical expertise. He was just saying it to make her feel better. Anyway, let's be practical. Even if they had been Harry's friends, they wouldn't have been over there every 5 minutes. He'd probably still be dead. He just wouldn't be quite as dead as he was today. He'd got deader and deader over the weeks it took before they noticed. She gagged at the sickly sweet sensory memory. A smell had never made her vomit before. Well, she'd never smelled death before. Oliver was an accountant. He probably hadn't smelled death either. But while she'd been sick in Harry's sandstone pot, Harry would have been furious. White-faced Oliver had calmly made the necessary phone calls, rubbed her back, and offered her a clean, precisely folded white tissue from his pocket. "Unused," he promised. Oliver was the man to have around in a crisis, a man with a tissue and a conscience. The guy was a freaking hero. "Oliver is a freaking hero," she said out loud, even though she knew Vid probably didn't need to hear any more about Oliver's freaking heroism. "He is a good man," said Vid patiently. He yawned. "We should have them over." He said it automatically, and now he must surely be lying there thinking of the last time they'd had them over. "Hey, I know, let's have them over for a barbecue," said Tiffany. "Great idea. Wait, haven't they got some really nice friends? Isn't one of them a cellist?" "That's not funny," said Vid, and he sounded profoundly sad. "That's not even a little bit funny." "Sorry," said Tiffany. "Sick joke." "For coffee," said Vid sadly. "We can have Erika and Oliver over for coffee, can't we?" "Go to sleep," said Tiffany. "Yes, boss," said Vid, and within seconds she heard his breathing slow. He could go to sleep in an instant, even on those nights when she knew he was upset or angry or worried about something. Nothing ever affected that man's sleep or his appetite. "Wake up," she whispered. But if she woke him, he would keep talking, and he'd been up since 5 that morning with the Aquatic Centre project. One of his boys had got sick, and he was worried he'd underquoted. The man needed his sleep. She turned on her side and tried to calmly sort her way through all the things that were churning through her mind. Number one, finding Harry's body today. Not a nice experience, but get over it. Harry was probably happy to be dead. He seemed like a man who was done with living. So move right along. Number two, Dakota. Everyone, Vid, Dakota's teacher, Tiffany's sisters, all said that Dakota was fine. It was all in Tiffany's head. Maybe it was. She would continue to monitor. Number three, the information morning at Dakota's new school tomorrow. Feelings of resentment. Don't you send me emails reminding me that attendance is compulsory? How dare you talk to me in capital letters? Probably related to subconscious feelings of inferiority over the snooty school and other parents. Get over yourself. It's not about you, it's about Dakota. Number four, but perhaps overriding everything else, her feelings of guilt and horror over what had happened at the barbecue. Like the memory of a nightmare you can't quite get out of your head. Well, yes, Tiffany, we get it. All very distressing. Over and over it we go, not achieving anything. Just stop thinking about it. You can't change what you did or didn't do, what you should and shouldn't have done. The problem was that every item on her list was so nebulous, impossible to pin down. She remembered the days when her worries were always related to money and solutions could be calculated. To comfort and distract herself, she worked her way through a conservative estimate of her current net present value. Property, shares, self-managed superannuation fund, family trust, term deposits, check account. Doing this always calmed her. It was like imagining the protective walls of an impenetrable fortress. She was safe, no matter what happened. If her marriage fell apart, her marriage wouldn't fall apart. If the stock market or property market crashed, if Vid died or she died, or if one of them got a rare disease requiring endless medical bills, the family was safe. She'd constructed this fortress herself, with Vid's help, of course, but it was mainly her fortress, and she was proud of it. Go to sleep, then, safe